2023 Mid-Atlantic Christadelphian Gathering. And again, we welcome our brother Roger Lewis from the Christ Church North New Zealand Ecclesia. But today's topic is how to minimize technology for a better spiritual life. Brother Roger.
So, thank you, Brother Bob, and good morning, everyone. Our topic today is something that probably you're going to think, what's he going to say about this? Because we live in a world of technology, and I'm going to use technology to talk about technology. So, there's a bit of a paradox here, isn't there? But we're going to examine the idea of technology, because as with so many things in our lives, what we've got to do is distinguish between what's good about the things we use and what might not be quite so good about the things we use, and how we might best use that knowledge in terms of our spiritual life in the truth. So if you've never seen this slide before, has anyone ever seen that picture before here? Excellent. Good. Now, in case you haven't seen that slide, you'll recall I've already talked about the red line and the blue line. And this slide is really about that idea. So it's saying that in the scriptures, how the scripture presents life and how the scripture presents humanity is that there are two seeds. The red line, the seed of the serpent, and the blue line, the seed of the woman. In fact, the Bible talks about two ways, two women, two trees, two houses, two masters, two cities, two communities. So the Bible talks about two. And those two are obviously different. They're sort of like two alternatives to choose, two paths to walk down. Now, you will know that if you come to a fork in the road and you decide, shall I go to the left or the right? Both the roads might look similar, but I tell you what, you're going to end up in completely different places. So making a choice about which road to choose when there's a fork in the road is obviously important, and that's partly what this is about. So to take those red line, blue line ideas, it's about spirit versus flesh. It's about truth versus error. It's about above versus beneath, holy versus unholy, wise versus foolish, light versus darkness, good versus evil, life versus death. So the thing about that is that the Bible consistently therefore talks about two seeds and two ways. And those two seeds are not just presented in Scripture as being different. They're presented in Scripture as being in conflict. So come, if you will, to Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. Now, you'll know this passage, but I want you to just have a look at it, like face to face, if you would. In Genesis 3, 15, because I just want you to notice a key word here. Genesis 3, 15, which is the famous chapter about the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. It says in verse 15, I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. He shall bruise thy head, which is probably how it should be translated, by the way. If you haven't got that in your margin, that's a good marginal addition. Why would he be a better translation? Any thoughts? Why would he be better than it? Any thoughts? Why would he be a better translation? Yes. Who's the he that will bruise the head of the serpent? So ultimately, it's about Christ, you're quite right. But if it says it, it's sort of like in the neuter gender, isn't it? So in the Hebrew, it should be, he shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. So the thing to notice about this verse is that there wasn't just going to be enmity between the woman and the serpent, but between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. Those two ways are going to be in conflict with each other. Now, that's a fundamental truth that we need to accept and understand, that will be the reality of life. All our life, there will be the experience of that conflict between the two seeds and the two ways. Mind you, if you live a life of the seed of the serpent, there's no conflict, because if you're living as a seed of the serpent thinker, practicing seed of the serpent behavior in a seed of the serpent thinking world, it'll be fine. The only sense of conflict will arise if you are in any way associated with the seed of the woman, and then you'll feel it. And that's the challenge that the Bible presents to us right at the start of the Bible. Now, let me show you why this is interesting. Come to the other end of the Bible. So come to Revelation chapter 12. And let me just show you something interesting. As the last book of the Bible talks about the unfolding of Bible prophecy, and it shows you why we need to start at the Genesis end of the Bible in terms of our Bible study and Bible understanding. So what it says in Revelation 12... right at the end of the chapter, you see what it says in verse 15. And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away. Now you see, only those who've read the first book of the Bible would be on high alert to read this passage in the last book of the Bible. A controversy between who? Between the serpent and the woman. Are now, where have we read that before? That's clearly an echo, isn't it? Bible echo? Genesis 3, verse 15. But here we're at the other end of the Bible now. We're now in Revelation. So verses 16 and 17 says, and the earth helped the woman, and the earth swallowed up her mouth, opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast, the serpent cast out of his mouth. And the dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which have the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So here we've got the serpent, we've got the woman, we've got the remnant of the seed of the woman, and we've got a war of hostility between the two. So what we're being told is that that enmity that began in Genesis chapter 3 is still at work in the end of the Bible in the book of Revelation. So this is the great theme of Scripture, you see. It's a continuous theme. We've got the enmity between the two. Romans 8 says, the minding of the flesh is death, but the minding of the Spirit is life and peace, and the minding of the flesh is enmity against God. These two ways are in permanent conflict. Galatians 5 says, walk in the Spirit, and ye shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh, for the flesh lusteth against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh, and these are contrary one to another. The word means to be opposed. They're in conflict with one another, says Paul in Galatians. So the clear teaching of Scripture is that there is an enmity between the two ways and between the two seeds. In fact, did you know that that understanding of that conflict is the basis of why we believe as a community in what's called the continuous historic view of Bible prophecy? We believe that down through time, the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent have been battling all the way through. There's been a controversy between those two seeds, and that frames how we see the unlocking of Bible history. So we've got the seed of the woman, and we've got the seed of the serpent. And we've got the thinking of the Spirit, and we've got the thinking of the flesh. And we've got the light of the truth, and we've got the darkness of error. And we've got those two seeds in permanent conflict, you see. Now, I said in our, I think, original class, that there's no doubt that the blue line of the seed of the woman will win, because God intends the blue line to win. Those who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. That's the community that God will enthrone upon the earth. But the Bible's very clear about the difference between the thinking of the Spirit and the thinking of the flesh. And we ought not to imagine that they're the same, because they're not. So this is what the Bible says. It says that man, in his own natural state, is actually in the ignorance of darkness. So Proverbs 8 says, the path of the just is as a shining light that shines more and more unto the perfect day, but the way of the wicked is as darkness. They know not at what they stumble. And we know also in Ecclesiastes 6 that he comes in with vanity and departs in darkness, and his name shall be covered in darkness, says Ecclesiastes. And John chapter 12 says, walk while ye have the light, lest darkness come upon you, for he that walks in darkness knows not whither he goeth. while you have the light, believe in the light. Light versus dark, light versus dark, light versus dark. But what these passages are saying is that man by himself is not in light, he's in darkness. Our natural thinking is darkness, not light. And did you notice another key word? Can anyone spot another key word, do you think, in those three passages? There's an interesting additional key word. What do you reckon? It's correct. And do you think that's significant? Because have a look, you see. They know not. They do not know. They know not. That's our natural state. From God's perspective, we're actually in darkness and we don't know. We don't know, we don't know. Now, why this is interesting is we do get to a certain point in our lives where we think we do know. We think we know everything. It's part of the journey, incidentally, of teenage life, is to go through that epoch of time where we think we know everything. Mark Twain had a very famous saying once. You probably heard it, but Mark Twain said this. He said, when I was younger, when I was a teenager, he said, I couldn't believe how little my father knew. And by the time I was 21, he says, I couldn't believe how much he'd learned. So there was like a change in his thinking. In fact, there's another famous saying about dads. And the famous saying about dads is, my dad's bigger than your dad. And the second stage of dad is, the old man doesn't know anything. And the third stage is, my father always used to say... It's sort of like a journey of life. And somewhere in the middle of all that, we do go through an epoch of time in life where we sort of think we do know. We know what we're doing, we know what we're up to and where we're going, and we don't really. We just think we know. But the teaching of the Bible is we don't know. We absolutely don't know. We're in darkness. But on the other side of the ledger, the positive side, is that God is the source of enlightenment. So the darkness hideth not from thee, says Psalms. Even the darkness is not dark to thee, but the night shineth as the day. The darkness and the light are both alike to thee. God is light, absolute light, the light of knowledge, the light of prescience. Daniel chapter 2 says, he gives knowledge to them that have understanding or no understanding. He reveals the deep and secret things. He knows. We don't, but he does, says Daniel. He knows what's in the darkness. And the light, well, the light dwells with him. It lives with God. And the first of Peter chapter 2 says, you're a chosen generation that we should show forth the praises of him who's called us out of darkness into his marvelous light. So you see the key words? The darkness hideth not from thee. It's both alike to thee. He gives knowledge. He reveals the deep things. He knows the light dwells with him, the praises of him into his marvelous light. So you see, this is the perspective of the truth, is that there comes a journey where we have to say, and we do get to the stage, by the way. I can promise you, you'll get to the stage where we finally say, actually, I don't know, but I believe God does. I don't know the mysteries of life, but I really believe that God does. So if God does, then I better find out how to think from his perspective, because there's always going to be a controversy between these two ways and these two lines. And I already should know from the Bible that the blue line is going to win. So if I'm not associated with the blue line, then I won't be part of the winning side. It's as simple as that. No one from the red line will be given an entrance into the kingdom. No one. Only those from the blue line. And perhaps not even all those. Well, that sort of brings us then to our subject for today, which is the question of technology. And we shouldn't be surprised that the challenges we face in terms of the thinking of the spirit versus the thinking of the flesh are very much going to be seen in the matter of technology itself. Now, here's the thing about technology. So we all know that there are benefits which technology might bring. Can you tell me some good things about technology? You got any suggestions about what technology might be good for? Yes. Just say that again. Easy to communicate in what way? So you're saying specifically texting? Okay, so is it as easy to communicate with texting as it is to speak? So actually, it depends what we mean. If you're texting for someone far away, then texting is easy. But if we're speaking to people who are within our vicinity, speaking's quite good, by the way. Speaking works really well. It's instantaneous transmission. You're always online, completely live, all the time. So yes, there could be a benefit, though, in communication under certain circumstances. Anything else you think that technology could be good for? Who's been in the ecclesia? Hands up those in the ecclesia where in COVID you had to go online with Zoom or something. Did most ecclesias do that? So, and that was a necessity of the times, wasn't it? And if we didn't have technology, we couldn't have met at all during those times. So perhaps that was a blessing that technology gave us. So there's no doubt that there's some benefits. We use computers. People can't do our work without computers these days in terms of contact with other people and exchanging on email. And there's things that require us to come together to use technology. But the question is, can we use technology in a way that's consistent with blue line thinking? Because the trouble with technology is it also brings significant dangers. Now, you know that some of them are obvious. Unrestricted access to immorality. I remember many years ago, a brother decided to buy a television. And he was really proud. It was coming off the back of the truck into his home, and they lifted the box off the truck, and on the side of the box it said, "Bringing the world into your home." And the brother said, "I'm really sorry, but I can't accept that. You need to send it back to the shop. I'm so sorry. I shouldn't be buying this." Because he suddenly realized that that's what it was going to do. It was going to bring the world into his home. But nowadays, we've just brought the world into our lives like that, haven't we? And everyone can have one of those, and no one's got any idea what people are doing. No idea what they're doing. And it might not be immorality, but it could be any one of a thousand other things which are not good as far as the truth's concerned, which undermine the truth. So, look, I've just got a list of some of the things which I think are potentially dangerous. I think that you'll probably know these, and you'll probably agree with them, but the question is more about what we do about it, because you've got to actually reach a point in your life where you've got to decide, how do I make choices here? And at the end of the class, I'm going to talk to you about a smart lesson from a farmer that tells us that when we talk about things that we use and the benefits that there are, that we need to be cleverer about how we assess the benefits and smarter about how we assess the dangers. So, here's technology. Got some benefits? Absolutely. But in fact, one of the things it does, funnily enough, is it inhibits good communication. Because you see, text messaging is not good communication. Twitter tweets turn everything into bite sizes, pieces of nothingness. The trouble is with tweets, you end up with little statements, and those little statements are all about little thoughts. And we have little sayings, as if that will solve the world. You know, none of it solves the world. None of it even gets to grips with the complexity of the world's problems. We use emoticons. You know the problems with emoticons? They're sort of like silly little faces that allow you to actually put a face on without saying what you really think, what you really feel, what you really say. No, you don't say it, you just put a face on. The face now describes how you feel. So one of the things about communication is, here's my thought for you on it. How do you communicate great ideas? Great ideas. Great in the sense of large, big thinking ideas. Well, I can tell you how you communicate great ideas. You need great words. And if you don't have a good command of words, you can't communicate good ideas. Language and thought are connected, because how do you think? How do we actually think? We think with words. If you're thinking about any problem in life, you're actually thinking using language to think about it. Now, if your language is small, if your range of language is small, then you won't actually think well about big thoughts, because you haven't got enough language to think well enough about it. And what texting and Twitter does, and even emoticons do, is they shrink our language. Did you know that that's actually been happening in the world, in the English world now, for several decades? That the vocabulary of people is going like that. You've got far less vocabulary now than your grandparents had. Your range of words is getting smaller and smaller. Give me a word that describes what sunset looks like. Can someone give me a word for sunset? The colours. Give me a word. Vivid. Okay, I'll take that. Vivid, yeah. What other words to describe a sunset? Picture the sunset. Okay, so it's vivid. What else? Yes? Idyllic. Give me the colours. Orange. Idyllic orange, of course, but... Orange, purple. Any advance on orange and purple? Yellow? Any advance on orange, yellow and purple? Give me some more nuanced colours. Ooh, I like that. Lilac, or it could be violet, it could be magenta, it could be purple, it could be auburn. There's lots of extra words. What about colours of blue? What blue would you see in the night sky? Would you see blue? Just blue? What other ranges of blue would there be as the sun sets over the far horizon? What other depths and tints of blue? Yes? Cobalt blue, indigo. So my point is, if I was asking you to describe sunset and said, give me every colour you can possibly think of, how many colour words could you think of? Have you got enough to express the beauty of that sunset? Now, here's my point. If you don't have the range of words, you can't describe that sunset as vividly as someone else could with more words. You just can't. Now, you're living in an age where what technology is doing is shrinking your vocabulary and your communication. You're paying that price every day. So the question is, are you happy to pay that price? And do you realise what that price will be in your future life? Because it isn't just about communication, it's about thinking. I think that what technology does is it damages genuine friendships. Has anyone here read Cheryl Turkle's book Alone Together? It's a really good book to read, if you want a good read. How does that sound, by the way, the title? Alone Together. Does that sound like an oxymoron or a paradox? And what she says effectively in that book is she says that in the vast platform of social media and social activity, what happens is friendships are a mile wide and an inch deep. In theory, we're more connected than ever before. But in reality, we're more lonely than we ever thought possible. Technology is a trick when it comes to friendships. Do you know the very best friendships? The ones you have face-to-face in person. You don't need to have 1,000 friends on social media. Most of them aren't real. Who are your best friends? Well, the most likely answer to that will be people that you regularly chat to on a face-to-face basis. They're your real friends. And they're the ones you want to nourish. These are the friends that will be friends probably for the rest of your life. The rest of them are superficial. But for some reason we've imagined that we've got to have them, got to have them, got to have all these friends. But it's actually not what the Bible teaches about friendship. The Bible's got lots of examples of close friends, deep friendships that were really powerful in the truth. Special friendships that inspired each other mutually in the things of the truth. You only need a handful, by the way. In fact, my experience is that in most of people's lives, they may only ever have a handful of friends, maybe only two or three best friends at the most. But they will be the most treasured of all your relationships. Technology is not helping with that. Technology is leading you away from friendships, away from good relationships by the very nature of how it operates. Have you thought about that? Have you thought about the price that that might bring? Here's another one. What technology does is it consumes attention. So there was a psychologist, Herbert Simon, that said that what information consumes is rather obvious. It consumes the attention of its recipients. A wealth of information creates a poverty of attention. So what happens is attention that should be spent in blue line activity ends up being spent again and again and again in red line emptiness. You've only got a certain number of minutes every day, and how we spend it sort of decides where we might go in life. Actually, let me just digress a minute. I'll tell you a wee story, because for the last few years, I've been teaching in organisations one key thing. I teach attention management. So I go into an organisation and I talk about how the attention of all their staff is being disrupted and destroyed by the bad practices that go on inside that company, and how that the attentional powers of their staff are their single greatest asset. But the critical thing is, when everyone walks in the morning, their bodies have arrived, but did their brains come? And the trouble is, you don't know, because who would know whether someone's paying attention? It's invisible. So I teach in organisations how to manage attention, your attention, every day. And I start with this story, which happens to be a true story, is they took two groups of people and they sent them on a forest walk. So every day they were going to go on a walk through a forest for 1 hour. But before they started this exercise, they took the vital signs of all these people. So they took their heart rate and their cholesterol levels and their blood pressure and their triglycerides and just a few indicators to see whether they were reasonably healthy or not, to measure the effect of this walk through this forest. So they're going to walk through a forest for 2 weeks for 1 hour a day. But to group A, they said, now, as you walk through the forest, keep an eye out for litter. Keep an eye out for the trash that people have dumped through the forest as you walk. See if you can see a spot in there. Keep an eye out for graffiti on some of the brickwork walls that are in the middle of the forest. Keep an eye out for damage to the trees. See if people have broken branches or squashed plants or trodden flowers into the ground. Keep an eye out for all that stuff. See what you can see. And to group B, they said, as you walk through the forest, just see the forest above you through to the canopy of the blue sky. See the dappled sunlight coming through the leaves, hear the bird song, and just immerse yourself in the forest and the feel of the trees. Just enjoy it. Now, off you go. Go for your walk. So they went for a walk for 2 weeks, and they came back, and they said to the two groups, how did you get on? Well, group A were as grumpy as heck, because they had seen signs of damage and graffiti and litter, and they were not at all happy with how people were treating the forest. And interestingly enough, not only did they not want to continue the walk, but their health indicators had got worse. Group B, they said, how did you get on with the walk? They said, oh, we loved it. Absolutely loved it. It's been so therapeutic. In fact, we'd like to carry on the walk. It's been wonderful. It's been so good. Same forest. Same walk. So here's the lesson. Now think about this in a wider context of your life. You only see what you decide to pay attention to. So be careful where you focus your attention, because it will totally shape the rest of your life. You have absolute choice as to where to focus your attention, but that's all you'll see. And if that's all you see, then that's who you will grow up to become. So our attentional powers are crucial. And that's a God-given power that we must use wisely, because we're not entitled to fritter it away on silly things. Actually, technology diminishes productive activity. One of the things that comes out of that is something called, anyone heard of multitasking? What's multitasking? Anyone like to give me a definition of what they think multitasking is? Yes. Yeah, being able to do, in theory, being able to do multiple tasks perhaps several of them simultaneously. Now, you know what? You can have a phone conversation and stir a pot. But you can't write an English essay and solve a Lagrangian mathematical equation at the same time. You just can't do it. The cognitive cost of those two exercises is so large that you cannot do them both at the same time. So when people talk about multitasking, do you know what they're really doing? They're actually switching their attention from one thing to the other. And the cost of that is large. I won't do this exercise, but can someone remind me tomorrow to test you on multitasking? I'll give you a little time exercise and show you how bad multitasking is and how painful it is for your brain to do it. So when we think that we can switch from this to this and that to that, and that's what actually technology enables us to do, to switch, to switch, to switch, to switch, to switch, we jump from this to that and this to that, what that's doing is actually making you far less productive. As a person, far less productive. Attention switching is hugely damaging to your focus and productivity. But technology doesn't just allow you to attention switch, it wants you to attention switch. It's encouraging you to attention switch all the time. You happy to pay that price? Did you know you're paying that price? And that you don't just pay that price today, you pay it as a consequence of who you'll become. Technology encourages shallow thinking. There's another really good book called The Shallows by Nicholas Carr. And what he said, what he shows, is that the technology of today is rewiring our brains and how we think and how we remember. And it's driving us into the shallows of distraction. That's where his sort of title comes from, the book, The Shallows of Distraction. Because what he's saying is that technology is making it impossible for us to do what's described as deep work. If I said to you, here's a really difficult task, I want you to focus for 90 minutes on that task with full focus, you might struggle to do that. You might struggle to focus your attention for 90 minutes. And the reason why you struggle to focus for 90 minutes is because your brain is being rewired so you can't think that long. You just can no longer think that long. Generations before, people could think for longer periods of time, but they weren't exposed to what technology does to their brains. And the last one is, and perhaps this is the most important one, is that what technology does is that it exploits addictive distraction. Now, I've met people that said, oh, look, I could put all my technology away if I wanted to and focus. No, they couldn't. They just couldn't do it. Even if they say that they can, but the reality is if I took all their technology off them and said, okay, you go and concentrate now for 90 minutes, they couldn't do it. Even if they wanted to. Because what's happened in many people's brains is they've already lost the battle for deep thought. They can't sustain their attention for anything more than a few minutes. Now, if we can't focus for anything more than a few minutes, how do you think that filters out to things like Bible meditation? Where we sit and read a passage and think about it. If you can't think for anything longer than a few minutes. How will that impact on your ability to spiritually meditate? There's a price to pay here, you see. And so every one of those outcomes is against the objectives of the truth. By the way, every one of those is an hour's study in itself to unpack that in more detail. We haven't got time, so this is just a summary. But every one of those is not actually serving the objectives of the truth. So what you've really got is this. Here's the reality. The reality is that technology is the work of seed of the serpent thinkers writing seed of the serpent programs to compel seed of the serpent behavior. Don't be deceived. That's exactly what they are. And if you immerse your mind, if I immerse my mind in those things every day, we'll end up in the red line. You see, perhaps distraction has always been a problem, but you see, what's happened with technology today is it exploits distraction in a way that didn't have to happen in the past. You see, we don't have to be bored these days. Even if we're all by ourselves, we don't have to be bored because we whip out our phone and we can watch a movie, clip a view, check a map, choose a shop, do an email, read a book, have a weather update, look at the news flash, click on a like, play a game. We can do something always. We need never to stop and think. Technology is available there always to distract us. But the price we pay is a terrible one. Now, you might know this, but if not, it's good to know. There was a moment of time when gambling machines... Do you remember that gambling machines used to be like mechanical machines? You sort of used to crank a handle and these numbers would come up and people would gamble on them. Well, at a certain point, all of the gambling machines became digital. So now they're being run by software. And the moment they could run them by software, they said, oh, now we can program these machines in a much more careful way than a mechanical machine could do. And what they did is built into the program of every casino machine the latest studies in persuasion techniques and psychological addiction. And that all comes out of one key idea called variable rewards. It's a little trick that they found hooks the brain and exploits user addiction. Here's a quotation from a guy called Nir Eyal, who's written on the subject of addiction to technology. Oh, and incidentally, he came from a technology company. He built technology to addict people and then realized this is bad what we're doing. This is really bad what we're doing. So he wrote a book against it, because he's actually been part of building those programs to hook you in and then realized that they shouldn't be doing so. So the hook model focuses attention and infatuates the mind. It was discovered by a man called Skinner 50 years ago, and it was a way to create compulsions. Variability is the brain's cognitive nemesis, and our minds make deduction of cause and effect a priority over other functions like self-control and moderation. It is the same impulse to search endlessly, never satisfied, that creates habitual behavior for many new technologies. So what they embedded was a type of system called variable rewards. Sometimes you win, sometimes you don't. Sometimes you win, oh, I didn't. And so what happens is people get addicted to, oh, it might be next time. Oh, just one more time, it might be next time. I might win next time. Oh, it must have been because... And so the brain becomes obsessed because... The variable rewards mechanism means you can never be quite sure whether it's going to be next time or not next time, so I'll just check one more time, just one more time, just one more like. I'll just check my program one more time. And they've actually totally trapped your brain. And if you don't break free from that, you'll live with that addiction forever. Every addict pays a price. And every addict claims they're not addicted. I think technology is an addiction. And I think we become addicted to distraction. Do you know what the average response time worldwide when people are working at their jobs and they get ding, a new email coming in, they're working on a really important thing. What do you reckon the average response time is before they sneak a peek at the email? What do you reckon? What time? They shouldn't be. They should be working on their document, but someone's emailed, so they might just peek a look. What do you think the average response time is before they decide to do that? Have a guess. Less than 1 minute, less than 30 seconds, less than 15, seven seconds. So that's the average response time globally to email indications. People are hooked. So today, technology comes to creating new habits by continuously cycling users through the hook model. When Facebook changed to put the likes idea on their Facebook page, they created user addiction. And that's what every social media company has been using ever since. Every social media company uses exactly the same process to hook you into what's called variable reward behavior so that you can't break free from it. You become addicted. I just think that too many people haven't realized that that's what's going on. And perhaps particularly young people. It's really strong. And it totally will affect your future. Because it's playing with your mind. It's doing more than playing with your mind. It's imprisoning your mind. So, this is what the Bible says. Sort of makes you think, really. While they promise them liberty, they're the servants of corruption. For of whom a man is overcome, the same as he brought into bondage. I think technology has the power to put us into bondage. Hebrews 2 verse 15 says that Christ came to destroy him that had the power of death, the devil, and deliver them who through fear of life were all their lifetime, fear of death rather, were all their lifetime subject to bondage. Romans 8:15, you've not received the spirit of bondage again to fear, but the spirit of adoption. Galatians 5, stand fast in the liberty of Christ and don't be entangled with the yoke of bondage. And we live in an age and in a world where technology seeks to put us into bondage every day. Do not be mistaken. Why do they do that? Because it's how they make money. It's all about the money. They don't care whether you're addicted. In fact, the more addicted you are to use their programs, the more money they make. You're just a tool to their ends. And you come along and pay the price every day. So it's a real challenge. I believe it's a real challenge. And so maybe this is part of the challenge. So I'd like you to do this, one of these sort of two sides of the board here. Again, just on a piece of paper. So I haven't given you this document to use, but if you just do that little sort of, you know, two sides of the balance sheet, and I just want to ask you to write down a stab, just on a blank piece of paper. Don't show it to anyone. This is yours alone. Keep it to yourself. But I want you to write down the number of minutes you think that you spend each day on these things. I'm not going to give you long, because I don't want you to start brooding about it, so I just want you to take a stab, right? Just your best stab, and it's completely private, remember? Keep it private. Text messages. Have a stab. 2 minutes a day? 5 minutes a day? 10 minutes a day? 30 minutes a day? Hour a day? 2 hours a day? How much time? Got it? Emails. Not business. Not business related. Got it? Good. Social media. How much time on social media? Was that a raised hand? No, you don't need to give the answer. Yeah, no, keep it to yourself. So I'm asking you to simply count up the minutes that you think you're spending personally on this, but I don't need you to share it. In fact, probably best that you don't. Surfing websites. Take a stab. Watching movies. Playing games. So this is per day. So just a rough stab is good enough. So you got a grip on that? Now let's look at the other side, blue line. Doing the readings. Be honest. Engaging in Bible meditation. Because this is every day, so minutes per day. So daily Bible meditation. How much time? 10 minutes? 15? 20? 50? Reading the writings of the Brotherhood. I mentioned the other day, we've got an astonishing amount of really good literature in the truth as a Christadelphian community, but have we read it? Offering daily personal prayer. How much time? Once a day? Twice a day? 2 minutes at a time? 10 minutes at a time? It's really interesting. You know, we're told that Samuel once, he says he continued in prayer all night. Could you imagine continuing in prayer all night? I'm astonished. How could you do that? Bible characters did. Prayed all night. I don't think we could do that. Attending ecclesial activities. Now, this is tricky because it's not every day, but you could average, you know, I go three times a week, and it's, you know, however many minutes for each of those meetings, and divided that by seven, and then we're back to a daily amount. So just some daily amount is good. And lastly, contributing to the work of the truth. So, look, here's my question. You know what I'm saying here. You don't have to tell me anything about the numbers. I simply want to ask you one question. Run the numbers of minutes on each side, and I'll tell you whether the red line of the seed of the serpent or the blue line of the seed of the woman will win the battle for your mind. I can tell you right now. You've got to decide. In fact, everything we do, we should be asking, is this red line or blue line? Red line or blue line? See, what people do is they say, oh, my technology is essential for my work. But you see, the problem is what people do is they overestimate the benefits and underestimate the dangers. Now, I was going to do this on the board, but I don't think I've got time. But I've got a really good example about the thinking that should go on here. At least I thought I had a very good example. Must be up here. And it's to do with the fact that we justify technology on the basis that, well, we need it. It does good for me for this reason or that reason. No one doubts that there might not be some benefits. Honestly, I understand that. But this example comes from a farmer who had to decide whether to actually buy a hay baler, because he was on a farm where you could make hay with a hay baler, but it should be obvious, if you've got grass growing in your fields and you can bale it up for hay, why wouldn't any sensible farmer buy a hay baler? There's a benefit to it, right? The farmer said, yes, but the problem is you've got to look at the other sides and the other parts to the equation before you necessarily buy a hay baler, even though there's an obvious benefit, free grass turned into hay. And so he started looking at the pluses and minuses, and he said, well, there's the cost of the fuel for the baler, the repairs to the baler, the shed to keep the baler. In his area, you had to pay taxes on the baler. And then the time he spent baling hay was time he could have spent doing something else, like raising chickens, which could be sold, and they produce revenue. They also produce manure, which can go back into his soil. And he also said that by not baling, I don't compact my soil by driving heavy machinery over my ground all summer long. In fact, what the farmer said is the most important thing to him was the long-term health of his fields. That's his baseline, soil fertility in his farm. And what he realised is when you add all the pluses and minuses up, that even though the hay baler could make grass, free grass apparently, that on the other side, the costs were far worse to making hay than if he just bought it in. And as a smart farmer, he made a good decision that he weighed up the apparent benefits of the hay baler versus the real downside of the hay baler and decided there's more downside cost than upside benefit. Now, the thinking behind this is to say, well, that's perhaps how we should actually look at technology. I think it's too easy to say, there's a benefit. It keeps me in touch with people. And there's been no truthful assessment of the downsides. So I'm going to commend that to your attention, and I want to finish with a suggestion that comes out of a book which I highly recommend that you read at some stage. It's called Digital Minimalism by Cal Newport. C-A-L, Cal Newport. Now, by the way, Cal Newport is Professor Cal Newport, and he's a computer science professor. So he's hardly anti-technology. He's a computer science professor, so he knows all about computers and technology. And he says in that book, Digital Minimalism, he says you need to get off social media. It's wrecking your life, and it's wasting your life. Get off it, he says. If you want to do good work, get off it. It's not serving good purposes. You end up the pluses and the minuses. So what he suggests that people should do is take a 30-day digital declutter. And he says, look, this is how it works. He says, take a 30-day break from all optional technologies. In other words, this is not stuff that you have to have for your job or your work. You could say, well, I have to have that. Okay. But there's lots of other stuff that probably is optional. And if it's completely necessary for some reason for your life, then perhaps you could put some rules about how you'll use that on a more restricted basis for the next 30 days. And then you write that list down. stuff that's fully banned, stuff that's partially banned, and you put that list somewhere where you'll see it every day. Because for 30 days, you're not going to do it. Just 30 days, 1 month, a digital detox. And then he said you aggressively explore higher quality interests to fill the time left vacant, to discover the type of activities that generate real satisfaction and help to craft a better life. So he says, don't just go off all those technologies. Now spend those 30 days discovering other better things you could do with your life, other more enjoyable activities that don't use those technologies at all. Now, do you think people in the truth could think of things to do? Yep. But even for people who aren't in the truth, they could discover all sorts of other things to do that no longer need those hours of time spent on technology. And at the end of the 30 days, he said, what you do is this. You now only reintroduce those technologies that fit with your highest principles. And even then, you'll decide how you'll use them. So don't just say, well, I use something because there's a benefit. Remember the hay baler? Of course there's a benefit to everything. There's also disadvantages. You need to have had a proper look at the cost on the other side. Now, here's his quotation at the end of that 30-day declutter chapter. He says this, and I thought this was, when you think about it, this is not a Christadelphian. This is A, a computer expert. B, he's a Gentile. So if I can put it this way, he's part of the seed of the serpent community. And he said this. He said, this process will help you to cultivate a digital life in which your technologies serve your deepest, deeply held values as opposed to subverting them without your permission. I think that's a pretty good comment from someone who's not in the truth. You need to think about technologies that will serve your deepest values, not subvert them. Because that's what technology does. So I think this is private stuff, really. I think this is something you need to go away and assess for yourself. And to do that exercise of saying, have I really counted the downside costs? And have I perhaps overinflated the upside costs or the upside benefits? And haven't realized what a large impact it might be having on my life, and most especially my future spiritual life. So I've run over time. Sorry to run over time, but can I commend that to your attention? By the way, those slides will be available at the end of the school, won't they, Brother Bob? Because I've handed them on, so they presumably will be available for distribution. Yep, at the end of the school. So, okay, thank you.